The burger gods have blessed us with an In-N-Out in Texas. So I'm happy, man.
A 3x3 animal style burger, which is three patties, lettuce, tomatoes, the onions, extra pickles. They grilled my patties on with mustard. So that's the whole animal style right here. These are the animal fries. It has the cheese, has the sliced onions on there, the sliced grilled onions, and then the spread, the special sauce that they put on it. So
I just have a 5-minute drive. It's just so overwhelming. I kept saying all night, pinch me, it doesn't feel real. It felt real in there. And it's crying again.
Well, you're passionate about In-N-Out. That's good.
I love In-N-Out.
That's good.
Oh my God, it's nostalgia.
Yeah, it is.
It took me back to Fontana and to San Bernardino and to living in California.
Yep. I understand.
I can't get over it. I can't. God, I want to keep that.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Life, doing a podcast once a month. Audio fan sends me a message last week. He goes, hey man, had a hard day. Wish you had a new podcast. I'm like, yeah, dude, me too. Tell me about it. Just when you start having fun, life gets in your way. You know, it happens all the time. I don't know about you. I am definitely ready for some warm weather. I got a new grill. Thing's a damn beast. Has two exhausts on top, kind of like chimneys that come off the top. Oh, it's huge. Bad boy gets hot so quick. It does a great job. So far, so good. The other one I had for years. And when we moved into the new house, it fell off the moving truck and it broke. And I think it kind of cinched the gas lines or something. So I kind of made do, and then I finally said, no, this thing's not working. I just tossed it. So it was time. Rick Sellers got me the other day. Rick Sellers from Pacific Brew News sends me this message on Facebook. Because I read this article about this restaurant that practices some molecular cooking techniques and comments to me that the food is basically genetically modified. And, you know, I left that out of my show when I talked about molecular gastronomy, that it's molecular gastronomy is kind of like, it's genetically modified food. And it threw me off. I go, man, I'm disappointed in you. You know better than this. You know, we're using natural elements in this food and, I don't have time for this. Comes back and says, oh, I know that. I was being facetious. You know, sometimes we just lose that stuff in translation. I mean, maybe I lost my sense of humor. I don't know. But it's true, you know, I find myself defending this a lot. And I'm going to find myself defending it a lot very soon. That molecular gastronomy documentary is done. And she sent me an advanced copy. It looks great. But, you know, there's some things in it that when it does come out, I know it's going to raise a lot of questions. Brian Malarkey from Top Chef, he's in it too. You know, he says, and he's right, he says that, you know, a lot of the compounds that were discovered that are used in, you know, molecular cooking techniques were basically used to preserve food, you know, to make food last longer on shelves. And that is very true. But that's not how we're using it. You know, case in point, my mother-in-law used to love this dish. Every Thanksgiving, we'd make this thing called a green bean casserole. And basically, it was a can of green beans that were French cut. Jolly Green Giant, I think. And then you'd mix the green beans in the can that were already cooked with a can of cream of mushroom soup in a casserole dish. You top it with some of those French's fried onions that were also in a middle aisle somewhere. Had a little foil top on top of them. You put those on top, you bake it in the oven, and that was the dish. It was an inside aisle dish. It was a Midwestern classic. It was like one of those, you know, recipes you get off the back of a can or in family circle or, you know, on Sunday in the food section. But she liked it, so I made it. That's not how I like to eat, but that's what she liked. So we'd make that every year. And finally, I put my foot down and go, man, we're eating fresh. You know, I'm growing green beans in my backyard. I can get them anytime. Well, actually, not really anytime. When they're not in season, I don't eat them. But I think you know, to say that simply because it's used in those dishes means that it's bad. Not really. Look, I'm using these compounds, natural compounds. Soy lecithin comes from a soybean. That's what we use for foams and airs. Alginate, scrubbed from the walls of brown algae. That's what we use for spherification. Calcium chloride, which is salt. For gels, we use gelatin, which is used in Jell-O. It's animal collagen. Those aren't bad compounds. And look, I add it to the fruit juice. I make the dish. You eat it. You're shitting it out tomorrow. It's coming out the other end tomorrow morning. It's not staying in very long. Enjoy it while it lasts. That is molecular cooking. That's modern cuisine. We're not using it to preserve food, modify it in any way. But yet I have to make that argument all the time. I'm constantly defending it. I run my stats on my site every month. Top hits are always about molecular gastronomy. The posts I've written, the shows I've done, the photos I've taken, always the biggest hits. Search terms, always molecular gastronomy. That's what brings people to my life as a foodie. So I got to keep it up. Keep people entertained. Anyway, it's getting old. It's getting really old. And it's about to get older. Hey, how great is Facebook? Twitter? I don't know. Twitter's all right. It's a bunch of noise, really. Look at me type of thing. But Facebook is great because you hook up with people. You know, Katrina hooked up with some friends. She's going through some stuff. And it really helped her out. Some people who, you know, were important to her life years ago that she disconnected with, and she reconnected with them. And it happens to all of us. A lot of our friends that we don't get to talk to every day, we see them on Facebook and we say, hello, what's up? You see pictures that they posted. I mean, look, I've been to every prom this year. I've seen every kid's prom pictures. All of my friends' kids that are in prom, I saw their prom pictures. Couldn't say that 5 years ago. I don't know, 5 years ago, I might not have given a shit. But now I do. So it's nice to have that. Anyway, I want to shout out to my friend Danny and his son Justin. I met up with them thanks to Facebook. I went to school with Danny, and we hadn't seen each other in almost 30 years. Yeah, I'm that old. And he looked me up on Facebook, started listening to the show from episode 1, became a regular fan, regular listener, and he was coming out here to help his son drive back from Camp Pendleton. His son's in the Marines. Camp Pendleton is a Marine base here in San Diego. His son Justin is a real Marine. Did a tour of duty in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Correction, not just a real Marine, a real man and a true American. So thanks again, Justin, for risking your ass for us. Good kid. Really a good Marine. He was being discharged from the Corps. He'd done his time. And Danny was coming out to help him drive back to Arkansas. But before they did, they wanted to hook up with me if I had time and have a beer. So I met them at Stone World Bistro at the brewery in Escondido. We had lunch, we had a few beers, had a great time. Really great seeing Danny again and meeting his son. Seriously, thanks to Facebook. And listen, if you come out to Southern California and you're going to be in the area of San Diego, you have to visit Stone. They're doing so many great things, serving locally grown produce, lots of seafood, beers from the area, beers from all over the place. There's a sustainable fish farm, not far. I think it's in Carlsbad. They serve fish there, the seafood. And now, I guess, they're expanding further south into San Diego County. They're opening a new brewery and a farm that they're going to run to grow all the produce for their restaurants. Stone is making so much progress. I guess the whole thing, the European invasion's not working out like they planned. A lot of regulations, a lot of licensing. They just can't, you know, pull it off. It's hard. They wanted to be the first craft brewery in Europe, and it's becoming a little tough. So they're kind of focusing their energy here. Which is great. It's great for the area. Anyway, Danny had some stuff that he shipped to me from Arkansas. It was a beer from Diamond Bear Brewing in Little Rock called Rocktoberfest. It's a Martin. Nice and sweet, like I like them. Very good. He sent over a bottle of port. I haven't tried that yet. And some Arkansas Lightning. That, seriously, this stuff will strip the hair off your balls. It's so strong. It's corn mash. They used to say Arkansas, where the moon shines in the basement. Very true. Anyway, great to see Danny. Thanks again for all the tweets, man. Facebook, amazing place. Just so great to meet up with people. Remember Classmates.com came out? It was years before Facebook. They wanted $25 a year to be a member. Facebook comes out. It's free. Everybody joins. Next thing you know, I don't know what Classmates.com is probably wiping its ass with its DNS, its domain name now. I don't think they're making any money. My Life is a Foodie group on Facebook. We talk there all the time, trade articles. I get show ideas from a lot of stuff that I see on Facebook. Katrina reconnected with so many people that have helped her through this, and it's great. Hey, listen, those of you who are waiting for a new episode of Dude Food, I'm sorry for the delay on that, but you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. I've made a decision on the future of Dude Food, and it's a big one. And I know that you're going to be, you know, really happy when I finally do announce this, but it's going to take a long time to do it. So I need you to be patient and just kind of hang out. But that's where my energy is going to go in this show and in the Dude Food project. But no, I'm working on it now. I've already started. I expect it to be completed in several months. It'll be well worth the wait. And the announcement that I'll make on this will be bigger than anything else. And there's a ton of work that I have to do, and it'll take a while. But it'll be worth it, really. Not what you're expecting. Although, if you know me, you'd expect this. But just know that when you do see Dude Food again, you'll be very glad that you waited. So we're going to have a beer today. We're going to talk about elitism. Food elitism. Because I think it's so stupid. And there are some that are elitists. We'll talk about them too. But look, this is about a lifestyle that I have chosen, that a lot of you chose, and that we just want to share it with others, in case they're interested. If you're not, fine. But we're not going to think of you differently about it. I just don't want to have to defend myself for choosing this lifestyle. I like to eat fresh food. I like to eat certain things because I think they taste good. And they kind of follow my principles that I want to support farmers, growers, things like that. And if you don't, that's okay. I'm not going to think differently of you. And you know what? If I did, fuck me. And who am I? Seriously, that is elitism. And there are people like that. And, you know, F them too. Anyway, this beer, Ovilla, it's a Belgian double from Sierra Nevada. I had it earlier last month. I was saving it. Don had come down. You know, Don comes down from Brazil. And I was saving it when we can get together. I thought maybe we'd do a show, drink the beer. Didn't work out. So the beer just kind of sat there. Beer looked lonely, and I said, well, shit, I got to do what I got to do, you know? So I drank it. I liked it quite a bit, but I didn't feel like talking about it here. Then Don shows up with it last weekend and said, you know, I looked at it. I go, we were supposed to have this last time you came down. So we had it together, liked it. I'm not sure if he was over the moon about it, but it was a very good beer. Now, is this beer something I'd write home to Mom about? Probably not, but there's something about this beer that I like, and I'll tell you why. When we had it last weekend, this is what clicked about this beer that I liked. If you're a home brewer, all right, and you brew an Abbey brown ale or a double, you know, a more of a dark amber Abbey-style beer, and you brew them a few times, you kind of know what that beer is going to taste like. I mean, you get used to it. You know that flavor. And then when you have it in another beer, it just tastes familiar to you. But years ago when you had these beers and you weren't brewing them and you were having them for the first time, you'd never had that flavor in your mouth before, right? So it was magical. And you'd spend good money on a bottle because it did taste so much different than everything else you'd been drinking. But now you taste it and it tastes like what you're brewing. And it's because you're brewing that beer now. You're used to that flavor. To a novice, it's a new thing. So to a novice, Ovilla is going to have that effect. It's going to hook you in. Not on you or me because, you know, we brew this beer. And not exactly this beer because this beer is a lot better than what we'd brew. But I brew a lot of beer that tastes like this. Actually, it's called Fat Tabby. It's named after my fat cat, Clark. Fat Tabby. Abby, you get it? With Tabby. Yeah. It's a brown Belgian double ale. It's great beer here. It pours brown. The Sovia, it's got a decent head on it, smells excellent, fruity, they're like apricots and ripe peaches, slight peppery nose from the yeast. But when you taste this beer, this Sovia, as with that Belgian brown ale or the double that you make, the pepper is not overwhelming when you put it in your mouth. It's more malty, it's sweet, like a loaf of bread you just take out of the oven. You know how bready that is with biscuit malt? That's Sovia. That is the beer, that's the kind of beer that brought us here. That's why we're brewing Belgian beers on weekends. Because of beers like this. It's rich, it's creamy, it's deep and fruity, it's slightly spicy when you smell it. It tastes great cold. Even when it warms up, it tastes good. It's a really good beer. This is the style that sold us on drinking Belgian beer for the very first time. The first time you tasted a Belgian beer, it was a beer like Ovilla. That's why you started to brew it. Because you'll plunk down $10 a bottle for a 750-milliliter bottle of Avia. You'll support Sierra Nevada, one of the greatest breweries in the country, home of the Chico strain of yeast that gave the West Coast Pale Ale its reputation. But you want to brew this beer. This is why we brew. Ovia and beers just like this, like Chimay, Grand Reserve, the Premier, those are the beers. Those are the beers that made Belgian beer popular to us.
You may have heard about our European project, and if you haven't, you might want to stop and go do a Google search on that right now. We're here to talk about the stuff that's going to be happening in San Diego County.
We are planning to open a Stone Company store in the South Park neighborhood of San Diego within about the next 30 days.
Which would be June 2011 to you folks at home.
So at the Stone Company store at South Park, we will be offering growler fills, of course our wonderful Stone merchandise. We will sell bottles and kegs of beer to go, and possibly some tasters occasionally.
So no longer, if you are a local resident down in the South Park neighborhood, do you have to make a trek all the way up here to Escondido. You don't have to travel as far. You can walk over, or South Park style, bike over.
The other thing we want to announce today is Stone Farms.
The creatively named Stone Farms.
That's right. The last time we used a focus group.
Well, you know our predilection towards local, organic produce, right? Natural conclusion came out of that.
Let's just grow it ourselves.
There's a small farm, not too far from here, just 10 minutes, that had been in organic production for years, but unfortunately, it eventually failed. And we had the opportunity, months later this year, to step in and revitalize the farm and hopefully make it work.
Yep. Take over operations and try to make a go of it. So one of the other cool things we've been able to do at Stone Farms is we put some pumpkins in the ground. We planted some pumpkins that will be harvested late summer, and we will be doing another collaboration beer for October release, a pumpkin ale. We will be brewing this with Dick Cantwell from Elysian Brewing and Patrick Rue from the brewery. So we're very excited about that, growing our own pumpkins for our own beer.
Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms, he was the guy who was in Food Inc. He was a farmer. He's more than just a sustainable farmer. He's a teacher and an advocate for the sustainable movement. He was given a tour of his farm on the second season of Avec Eric, which was on PBS. And I think he's only done two seasons of that. Great show if you get a chance. DVDs are available. Anyway, it's fascinating to hear Joel talk. And I'm going to play some audio here. Now, he's going to say some things that a lot of people are going to argue with as being irrational, far-fetched, not very practical. And I know what your points are, and believe me, I see those points, and that's going to kind of be the basis of this discussion about living locally and how expensive it might be, or living life, the cost of living locally. And is it elitist to try to do so? Listen to this audio. I'll give you my two cents.
See, what happened in the industrial food system is that the scale of everything got so obnoxiously anti-human that we sequestered it in sectors. We hid the chicken houses out over the hill. We put the industry out over this and that. And what we want is to create an economy and a society and a food system in which the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker are viewed as assets in a community, not liabilities.
Well, this is wild carrot or Queen Anne's lace. Here's narrow leaf plantain. That's a medic. That's a blood cleanser. And then here's your wide leaf plantain.
So okay. Can we use that for us to make teas or for our consumption?
Plantain teas are medicinal.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. So what you're showing me, it's a diet that is
diversified. That's right.
And
so when the cow comes they have that,
mm-hmm. And it must be tasting delicious to them.
Absolutely.
And therefore, it's probably, in terms of flavors and nutritionals, much better than what
corn.
If you give them corn, for instance, right?
Yes. In 50 years, we've had three diseases in our animals, three times. And every single time, they were our fault.
So the animals do not need antibiotics because of their diet.
Exactly.
It's what you are saying.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that is a big statement. If the animals don't need antibiotics because of the diet,
right.
It's completely changing the way we are thinking.
My own experience confirms my own thinking that generally when there's a problem, it's not some the bad guy is a symptom of something going on in the system.
In the system.
Yeah. So every day those gals get a new salad bar. This is what the cow wants to eat. Now the interesting thing is that, of course, those cows in nature, they don't eat grains. They don't eat grains. They certainly don't eat dead cows. And they don't eat chicken manure and dead chickens. In our county, the average is 80 cow days per acre. In other words, that means an average acre would feed 80 cows for one day or one cow for 80 days in a year. Our average here is 400 cow days per acre.
Wow.
And we have not planted a seed or bought a bag of chemical fertilizer in 50 years. Now, we call this mob stocking, herbivorous solar conversion, lignified carbon sequestration fertilization.
Say it again.
And if everybody who had cows in the U.S. would practice that model, it so invigorates and converts solar into carbon that in fewer than 10 years, we would sequester all the carbon that's been emitted since the beginning of the industrial age. That's how fast this can happen. Now, if you'll notice, as you look around, this is where the cows were 3 days ago. And you notice how the chickens have scratched out to where you can hardly even see where all the cow pats were. And so we follow the cows with the egg mobiles, which these are laying chickens, egg layers. And they just free range out. And they cover this ground and eat out the fly larvae from the cow patties. That pays their salary for doing this work. And in the process, they scratch the cow patties into the soil surface to stimulate the incorporation and cover more ground with the cow pat, sanitize it behind the cows, and then as a byproduct, they lay us $50,000 worth of eggs. And the beauty of this is that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have your ecology and your economy at the same time.
Okay, so according to Joel, you've got a few acres of land, you've got some cattle, you've got some chickens, the cows come, they eat all that fancy stuff you've planted, salad bar as he puts it. They take massive cow dumps all over the place. Then the next day, you move them to another spot while the chickens come to that same area, eat all the worms that are growing in the poop, the thought of which makes me nauseous. I'm glad I'm not a chicken. And at the same time, these chickens are knocking out 50 grand worth of eggs a year. Not a bad way to make a living, and your animals are not sick. They're happy. You're happy. What a wonderful life. He is Farmer John. He's that guy you see in the drawings of the farmer on the labels in the supermarket. This is that guy. He's farming. He's growing the way things used to be done back in the day. But most people cannot afford to eat the food that Joel grows. People like Joel, you know, the stuff that they're growing, that is expensive. That is an expensive way to farm. Now, he might tell you otherwise, but go check the price. When you're raising a family of four, it just doesn't seem logical in this economy to buy food raised this way. And that's the argument you're going to get from most people. And listen, it is 2 to 3 times more expensive than commercial grain-fed beef because it costs the farmers far more to grow them that way than the way commercial farmers are growing them. So naturally, they're more expensive. And money is tight everywhere. We're not in good shape economically. This entire situation sounds like a pipe dream. And I have to wonder if it actually is. In this country, and I've said this 100 times, we eat a lot of beef. We eat a lot of food in general, and we waste a lot of it too. And I've said this before, and perhaps it's in the defense of the beef industry in a way. These farmers will grow their cattle the way Joel does, but you have to say goodbye to 99-cent hamburgers at fast food places. I mean, think about this. We get pissed off paying $4 a gallon for some gas. And even gas, they're not even raising the price of beef because it's becoming more expensive to grow them. It's becoming more expensive all around because of the price of gas. So imagine if McDonald's suddenly was selling a hamburger for $3 instead of 99 cents. Well, they were doing this on the news not long ago, out here in California anyway. There were some franchises, some McDonald's franchises, that raised the price on the value menu, which is supposed to be 99 cents, to $1.10. People shit their cage. I'm not kidding you. Now imagine if a 99-cent hamburger suddenly becomes $3. That's what we're faced with if the cost of growing these animals goes up for everybody. And I'm going to talk about two sides of grass-fed beef here because that's basically what he was talking about. There is good grass-fed beef, and there is some bad grass-fed beef. For those people who do manage to fit things like organically grown foods, like grass-fed beef, chickens, things like that, into their diet, it then becomes a lifestyle for them. And what really becomes an issue, with me anyway, is that when people do this, other people start to call you an elitist. Granted, if you're poor ass broke, it's literally impossible to live a lifestyle like this. But it is possible if it is really important to you. If you crunch some numbers, and I don't mean to sound like the Whole Foods version of Susie Orman here, but if you look closely at what you're spending your money on food-wise, and by that I mean everything, including those trips to the sports bar or the brew pub for dinner, for lunch, nachos, tacos, hot dogs at the ball game, things like that. If it's a drive-thru at Taco Bell, whatever burger joint you like, add it all up. What's it costing you? And then crunch the numbers on eating, you know, the whole way. If you decided to do that, that would suddenly make you an elitist? Foodies get labeled elitist all the time. I don't get that. I never have really understood why, you know, eating locally or trying to eat right suddenly gets tagged as being expensive. It doesn't have to be, you know, backbreaking. I don't think about how much I spend on food because it's the most important thing in my life. It does not cost a lot to eat at home. It costs a lot less than the way people who argue about this elitist way of living actually live their lives. But to think that suddenly we're going to change the way farmers raise their animals because it's the right way, that is thinking elitist. But people are suddenly, you know, spending their money on this stuff because once you get a taste of something that tastes this good and this fresh, and then you get used to that, you have a really hard time going back. If you live close to a butcher like Lyndon Grundy or any local butcher shop that sells, you know, meats from local farms, go in there sometime. Ask them for something. See if they're not close to selling out. People are buying this stuff because they've never tasted anything like it before. It's spectacular. They're discovering farming and the true taste of beef, chicken, pork for the very first time. It's invigorating to them. Again, it's not for everybody. And that's understandable. Single income, 5 mouths to feed, hard to pull that off. Absolutely understood. And I have heard numerous stories of people who are living this way, who do try to feed their families healthy dinners a few nights out. And this message is not directed at anybody, because I know there are a lot of people who just can't afford it, and it makes sense. But again, not all grass-fed beef is worthy of this kind of praise. Case in point, and I'm not going to say where I got it, but I paid about $17 a pound for locally grown grass-fed beef recently. I asked for ribeye, not sure what the hell cut of meat it was, maybe sirloin. It was like a wedge. He goes, oh, I'm having problems with my butcher. I said, yeah, no shit, look at this thing. 2 inches thick on one end, half an inch thick on the other. I'm looking at this thing, I go, this does not look like a ribeye. It was dark. I go, what the hell's with the color here? He goes, oh, that's fresh grass-fed beef. Butchered in on Wednesday. I thought, okay. New experience. Non-aged beef. Never had that before. It's always worth trying something new, you know? No, it wasn't. Tasted like tenderloin. Beef, you know, filet mignon. Livery, gamey, not pleasing at all. Not to mention all these rules that came with the meat. He says to me, have you ever cooked grass-fed beef before? I had. But I wanted to hear what he had to say. So he tells me, don't sear it. It's ultra lean. Doesn't have any of the fat that you're used to in regular steaks. Got to season it. Cook it low and slow in the oven 40 minutes. Gets you about medium rare. So I said, okay. This is an experiment for me. 40 minutes in the oven got me medium rare. Also got me a shoe. An expensive shoe. And it tasted really bad. No marbling, nothing. I swear, this may have been a piece of London broil. It just wasn't good. But what's funny about this is that earlier in the week, I had just grilled a veal chop that was also grass-fed, but it was finished on grain. The majority of cattle are grass-fed at some point. but it's really what happens at the end of their lives that gives the most flavor impact. And the end result of that veal chop that was finished on grain was maybe the most phenomenal piece of meat I've ever tasted, ever. I was over the moon eating this thing. So it had me thinking about how great a piece of whole grass-fed beef was going to be. So not all grass-fed beef is great, which is why you have to ask questions. And ask away. Most people who are selling you grass-fed beef are more than willing to provide you with information on it and tell you where the cows were raised, what they ate, what they were finished on, and even what kind of a cow it is. Because listen, if you're paying $17 a pound for some meat, you can ask all the questions you want. If I'm paying someone $17 an hour to come and work for me, you better believe I'm going to ask a lot of questions before I do. The same thing applies for meat. You're not being a pain in the ass. You're being a wise consumer. Just know what you're buying before you plunk down hard-earned cash.
Everything is grass-based. You know, they don't eat corn or dead cows or chicken manure like, you know, they feed right here in the valley, or dead chickens. They actually eat grass, forage, you know, clover, grass, herbs. So they're herbivores. If they were eating corn, you're going to have to harvest that corn, transport that corn, and then you're going to have to haul all that manure somewhere out the from the comes out the back end. Here, it's there is the whole thing. I mean, the cow is, she's fertilizing, she's mowing. We don't have to spread any manure. We don't have to harvest it. She's harvesting it. I mean, it's all real time, real solar dollars.
Another issue that we have to deal with is how men really have started to become the food elitists, and this is a problem. This girl Jessica, she wrote a piece recently for the site called xojane.com. She titled it, Men I'm Over, Foodies. She wrote, once I was blown off by a guy who makes pickles for a living. We were both alone at a bar in Park Slope one afternoon. He asked me what I was reading. He was an art director or something before, but now he spends his days knee-deep in brine and makes pickles. He goes, I love it. He did something weird with his eyes to let me know how sincere he was being. He talked about his pickles for about 45 minutes, during which I was able to conclude not only that are they much more flavorful as a garnish than as a subject, but it's possible to have an extremely large ego even while you discuss the merits of canning. So what do you do, he asked. He waves the bartender down for another beer. She says, I write articles. In the short break from talking about him and his cucumbers, he had actually pivoted around so his back was toward her and he was facing another chick. He looks over his shoulder and he says, sorry, food friend. So she writes, this is when I started to hate foodies, especially foodie men, who somehow making even prepared simple foods a macho, one-sided event. If a dude who makes pickles for a living can ask you if you've ever heard of his spicy asparagus with the same sort of smugness as a guy in Williamsburg who asked you if you've ever heard of his band, then women, we are in trouble. She goes on to write, I used to have daydreams about walking around the farmer's market with a man and picking out food to cook together. In my fantasy, I'm wearing a sundress and we're stopping to laugh at some misshapen squash or feeding each other a sugar snap pea. In reality, the men I found who want to linger at farmer's markets are like obsessive teenage boys at a vinyl shop. What kind of soil were these grown in? This is a rare one. We will be doing men a favor if we don't let this become a thing any more than it already has. For those men who neurologically look at the origin of every ingredient, who regularly order things like pork belly and make fun of how I say radicchio, you know who you are, asshole. It's fine to eat healthy and homegrown food, but you can be quieter and nicer about it. For those men who actually do grow and butcher and preserve the stuff we buy on the weekend to impress people, it would be nice to remind them that food is vital and growing it is sexy because it makes you seem down to earth. And I could not agree more with what she's saying here. This leads back to a lot of what I covered a couple shows ago when I said enough already. Some people, some foodies, have become real pains in the ass. I appreciate food. I love doing what I do. It's a lifestyle. I love it. But I always make sure to keep my ego in check about this. Am I proud of what I do, what I've accomplished? Yeah. Do I gloat? I try not to. No. Do I think I'm better than those who don't eat fresh, who don't believe in the same principles that I do? Hell no. That's elitist. What's not elitist is the lifestyle I've chosen for myself. It's right for me. So I want to share it with others. It might be right for you too. If it's not, that's fine. But that's why I choose this platform. I've made sacrifices that allow me this lifestyle. It's good for me. It may not be right for you, but it's good for me. To say that I'm elitist by association, that's like saying you're a thug asshole simply because you like to root for the Oakland Raiders. I know and love a lot of friends who root for the Oakland Raiders. That's their team. Does not make them the same as other Raiders fans who beat up people or get in fights while they tailgate. We have some bad seeds in the foodie world, I agree. Some people take it way too far. But simply choosing the lifestyle and sharing that lifestyle with others doesn't make us an elitist. Pim Tichmanovit, I think that's how you say your name, she's an elitist. She's a food blogger, wrote this book called The Foodie Handbook. Wrote it, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. I don't remember how long ago she read it. In this book, she said there are 50 things that every foodie should do in order to call yourself a foodie. Like rent a house with a kitchen in Italy or France for like a week. Eat a whole roasted turbot on the Basque coast in Spain. Dine at a Parisian three-star restaurant. If you order a bottle of wine, make sure it's in the middle range of $75 to $100 a bottle. That is elitist. And as a man, as a dude, trying to really immerse myself in this whole food thing, being associated with a smug chick like that, not really high on my list. I'm a dude. I watch sports. I drink beer like it's water. Never apologize for the amount of meat that I eat. I stare at tits like it's a sport. The food thing just happens. I'm as passionate about food as I am about the Yankees, Dodgers, Lakers, Ducks, Huskers, Formula One races on the weekends during the summer. If you want to call me elitist, you don't know me. And listen, if you call me an elitist, I don't think I want to know you either. I'm sorry, did that sound elitist? Okay, so there's a documentary coming out on El Bulli called El Bulli Cooking in Progress. It already showed at South by Southwest in March, and it's going to be released in limited markets this summer. They didn't have a trailer. I wanted to play a trailer for you, but I can't play it. But Ferran Adrià, he announced that he's got this deal that he signed with a Hollywood producer with a reported budget of $40 million to do an actual movie that would mix fact with fiction and use actors alongside real chefs on location in the kitchen of his restaurant. It will be something between The Social Network and Ratatouille. Still in the early stages of development, the film will focus on the lives of trainee chefs who work alongside Adrià in the kitchens of El Bulli, creating such dishes as olive oil caviar, pinecone mousse, and Parmesan snow. The film will be based on a new book, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, a season at El Bulli by Lisa Abend, published in the UK last month. The author spent the 2010 season with the apprentices who worked for 6 months. They worked 14-hour shifts for no pay and only one meal a day just for the privilege of working under Ferran Adrià. It is, she says, kitchen slavery, but would make a great sort of boot camp film with a love story thrown in. You know, this sounds like a recipe for disaster. First of all, working 14-hour days, that is slavery. That is kind of like boot camp. It's pretty hardcore. Why would you want to throw in a love story? I mean, that's how that movie No Reservations turned into a pile of shit. Make it about cooking, you know? Skip the love story. How about these kids finally get fed up working 14 hours a day and they come in one day with a hatchet and murder everybody? I mean, it's like working at a post office for a boss you can't understand. That's a movie. Keep it real. Love story? Okay, 14 hours a day in a kitchen, you get a little bored, maybe have some of the chefs skipping away in the meat cooler, knock out a little sexual tension during dinner service or something. I'd keep the romantic crap out of it. And there's a lot of potential here. Just, man, they always have to screw it up with romantic comedy storylines, rom-coms. It's a cross between The Social Network and Ratatouille. One's a docudrama. The other's a fictional cartoon about a talking rat who cooks. How the hell can you make something between that? I mean, it sounds like someone's about to flush $40 million down the toilet. You may as well wipe your ass with $1,000 bills. Whenever someone comes to you with an idea and they say it's a cross between this and this, or it's this meets this, you know their idea is unoriginal and you're about to blow some serious cash on a bomb. You think Brad Bird went to Pixar or Disney to pitch Ratatouille and he told them it was a cross between something? No. No, because it was original. Go original or go home. This is why Hollywood sucks. They should make a movie where a chef like Ferran Adrià is working these 14-hour-long days doing molecular gastronomy. One day he finally snaps, right? And turns out all these spherifications he's been making, these caviar, he puts them in this special $5 million incubator and hatches them. And it turns out all this time he's been working on an experiment to genetically manufacture robo-chefs to take over every kitchen, not only in Spain, but all throughout the world. Then suddenly these chefs are everywhere. They're cooking in every kitchen and every restaurant. And then one day, as he's sitting in the office of his secluded mansion, he presses a button on this big control panel. And these chefs suddenly shut down. The entire world is left without anyone manning the kitchens. Now, all of a sudden, all these rich spoiled bastards who eat at fancy restaurants all over the world are left having to cook for themselves. And they don't know what to do because they're so used to everyone cooking for them. That starts a real food revolution. Now that's a movie. That would be a movie. We could call it El Bullshit. That's an idea. This is why I don't work in Hollywood, people. Anyway, that's all I have for the day. You can follow us on Twitter, join our Facebook group. You can do all this at our website, mylifeasafoodie.com. If you like the music we play in today's episode, you can buy it directly from our website. You can buy it from Amazon.com or iTunes, either way. Just click the links in this episode's post. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Cheers. Decision I make. How can I be an individual with the weight of the world and eight other planets to take? And with everything happening, gunshots clapping and people all running in every direction with their hands up, praying for the drama to end. I got my hand down, looking for some money to spend. The price tag on the things I need, I get it bigger by the day. Attention!